We are talking about the salmon fisheries in Bristol Bay, Alaska, and a proposed copper mine, Pebble Mine, with Laura Orleans, folklorist and founding director of the Working Waterfront Festival. Sarah Schumann is a Rhode Island resident who's worked as a salmon cannery machinist in Bristol Bay. And on the phone from Washington, D.C., Brett Verhoosen, who is a federal fisheries coordinator for commercial fishermen for Bristol Bay, also a lifelong Alaskan fisherman. So, Brett, tell us about the life cycle of the salmon and why the salmon runs of rivers are essential to the health of the salmon stocks.
Sure. I mean, salmon are cool. Salmon are just such a cool fish when you really think about it, because basically the life cycle starts, after, say, the parents, they get into the river systems, and then they stop eating. Most of the, like the sockeye salmon in particular, stop eating. And so they're this beautiful silver on the outside, and their flesh is this fatty, meaty, red flesh. And then as they go up and they switch from salt water to fresh water, and they're going up from the ocean into the lakes and river systems to spawn, they kind of turn this crazy color where the kind of the pigment within their meat winds up getting kind of pushed out to their skin, and so their skin becomes this magnificent red, and their faces are kind of green, and they kind of become a little gristly. And so the salmon go up into the lakes and river systems and spawn, and then they die immediately or shortly after that. And so those carcasses are, fertilizer for these rich ecosystems, and they're feeding all sorts of other wildlife. And then those eggs that are now fertilized in the little bedrock hatch later in the spring. And and I'm speaking mostly about sockeye salmon, they'll kind of chill out and stay within the small little streams and rivers for a year or two, kind of grow up, learn how to be adults. And then once they're feeling ready, depending on kind of the weather and the climate, they will go down the current and into the major river systems and eventually back into the ocean. And assuming they survive all the predators along the way, then they swim out in the Pacific Ocean. And nobody is totally certain on the routes they take, but they definitely kind of swim in kind of like big circles, and they're out feeding and growing up and getting big and fatty and delicious for quite a few years, and then they return back to Bristol Bay where they are, commercially harvested or for subsistence use and for other uses, and then the life cycle starts back up again. So they're just a cool fish. Yeah.
And in the film, it's interesting because they talk about, when the fish come, it's like, will they come? Of course they'll come. But they're always preparing, for that, right, for that, the fish to come. And they have always come. They will always come, kind of a thing. And they get a little worried, but the fish always do come back. Sarah, I want to ask you about, you mentioned the chefs, and this is chefs all over who are interested in the salmon that comes from Bristol Bay. You have some involvement in some sort of a food to table kind of a program. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a bit of a tangent because the food to table program that I'm involved with, which is called Eating with the Ecosystem, is part of the locavore movement, which means being in New England, it deals with New England seafood, not Alaska seafood.
Okay.
But, the same chefs, of course, you can't any longer obtain wild salmon from New England waters. You once could a couple hundred years ago before we essentially destroyed their habitat by damming the rivers during the Industrial Revolution, which is exactly the kind of habitat impact we want to avoid in one of the last greatest salmon fisheries on Earth, the Bristol Bay salmon fishery. But given that we can't obtain wild salmon from our local waters, a lot of New England chefs still want to use it because of its amazing flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty plugged in, and they know that some of the most sustainable fish on the planet is Bristol Bay salmon. And so they take quite a lot of pride in serving that, putting it on their menu, labeling where it came from, and spreading the word about how delicious that fish is, how important it is to the lifestyle and economy up there, and how consumers can help protect it by telling our elected officials how important it is to protect that habitat in Bristol Bay from this proposed industrial mining development. And if any of your listeners would like to help support this cause, we do encourage them to reach out to their elected officials, like Senator Elizabeth Warren, who has not yet weighed in on this issue, mm-hmm. and let them know that we stand with Bristol Bay residents and commercial fishermen in opposing the Pebble Mine.
Yeah.
It's also, you know, it's also important that we thank those elected officials who have listened to their constituents and the concerns they have over the proposed Pebble Mine in Alaska, because you really have some great champions there locally. Bill Keating especially has been doing an excellent job and writing letters and organizing his other congressional members, such as Congressmembers Tierney and Markey at the time, who is now a senator, have all weighed in. And the fishermen in Bristol Bay really appreciate it, and that's because we were able to get such great support locally from fishing organizations and seafood companies like the Cape Cod Fishermen's Alliance there in Chatham has been a huge and instrumental help. Davis Seafoods, John Nagel Company, Gloucester Fishermen Wives, Red's Best Seafood, all these organizations in Massachusetts and up and down New England have really started to add their voices into this nationwide coalition, and it's been extremely effective. And definitely want to emphasize that thanking these members who have stuck their necks out for us is extremely great. That we're extremely grateful for their support.
I was saying, it isn't just fishing organizations. I think in the film at the end, they mentioned things like Tiffany's and some other jewelers have said they would not buy any of the metals from this mine. And I thought it was interesting because the film ends, and we know this has been ongoing. So maybe we can give it a little update on where we stand. You talked about the EPA, but there was a recent poll. I think when the film came out, there was probably a little more support for it than it is now. The recent poll I saw was 60% of Alaskans did not approve of this. What's standing in the way? Where are we? And I guess one of the major investors had pulled out. Where are we now, Brett, in this?
Yeah, we've had a really good couple of years. In a David and Goliath fight, we've been able to mobilize all the Davids and almost pull down the giant totally. And so as Alaskans get more and more educated about the risks of Pebble Mine, we've seen that statewide support increase to over 60%. And Alaska's a pretty pro-resource development state, but a lot of people now realize that this is just the wrong mine in the wrong place, and that the risks are just too high. And back in September, we also saw the half owner of the Pebble Mine agree that the risks are too high, and that is mining conglomerate Anglo American, who pulled out of its 50% ownership. Over $541 million were left on the table, and they cited that they were going to focus more on more profitable and less risky ventures in their portfolio. And then most recently, just before Christmas, another mining conglomerate who owns part of the parent company, Northern Dynasty, Rio Tinto, announced that they are looking into whether or not they are going to divest from their stake. And so we've seen this progression starting back 3 years ago with Mitsubishi, now, and then with Anglo, and then hopefully possibly with Rio Tinto, all of these major mining companies seeing the very loud support that people have for the salmon and that are against the large-scale mining being proposed in Bristol Bay and saying, you know what, this is just, the risks are just too high and the writing's on the wall.
Right.
And so we expect the EPA to release its final watershed assessment, the scientific document, any day now. And from then on, it is up to all of our champions and anybody else who wants to weigh in to be voicing their support to the EPA and to the Obama administration to say the science is clear. And it's finalized. It's been twice, you know, it's been peer-reviewed. It's been have over 1 million public comments. The risks are too high. Wrong mine, wrong place. stop pebble mine.
But let me just ask you this, because you mentioned this, which seemed like such an uphill battle. You said you gathered all the Davids. And as we mentioned, there's not a lot of people who live in this region. So can you talk a little bit about the process? Because I'm sure there's other, you know, when you see, you're up against, you know, a lot of money and, you know, something that seems like a really, really tough fight. There might have been some people who would bet that this, that you would not, and not that this is over yet, but would not expect this kind of an outcome. So what was the process? How did this come about? I mean, how did you rally the forces, so to speak, and what was the process to get this done?
Well, I think it, you know, in order to organize a coalition, it's a series of many steps, and a lot of it needs to be based on good science. And so when you have the science on your side, you're able to then use that science to educate anybody from the grassroots level all the way up to the grass tops decision makers. And that's what we've been doing for the past decade. I mean, this battle has been going on for a long time. And so it started regionally and bubbled up statewide. And then we, all the different coalitions, like you mentioned, we have, you know, a great support base from Trout Unlimited and the Sportsmen and the Hook and Bullet crowd. We have a great base with the commercial fishermen, and we've been able to go to, you know, I've personally been going to Boston and Chatham and other places up and down New England and the West Coast to raise this issue and have local fishing voices lend their concern. We've had jewelers start to weigh in and say that they're not going to buy dirty gold like Tiffany's. And so it's just been a very it's been a very thought-out process on how to organize all the stakeholders and bring those voices to a national level. Mm. And that's been really important, and that's what this film has helped do. This film was made quite a few years ago, and it's still just as pertinent today, and it's been an extremely effective campaign tool to, you know, basically bring Bristol Bay to other cities. I've gone on road shows showing Red Gold, and we've packed the theaters, and that's because it's a great film. I mean, it's a beautiful film with a great soundtrack, I might add, and it shows kind of the true essence of what Bristol Bay means to everybody.
Right. I wish that we're talking more about the opposition today, but the film does have both sides in the, I mean, you do get to hear arguments on both sides for and against of this proposed mine. Laura, tell us a little bit about, on the last few minutes we have here, the documentary series, how you pull these films together. You know, like,
sure.
You know, how did this one come across your radar
Well, this
screen?
One came across thanks to Sarah, who must have, I don't remember how we connected with each other. I think she sent me an email and said, you know, there's this issue and this film, would you be interested? And I asked to see a copy of it. I usually, you know, vet the films before we proceed. But basically, we've produced the festival for 10 years. And I think from the very beginning, we began showing films as part of, you know, one of the program activities at the festival. And there's so much else going on that it's really difficult for anybody to devote, you know, 45 to 60 minutes and really watch a film when you want to see the scallop shucking contest and you want to go on a boat tour and whatever. So about 3 years ago, we approached the National Park in New Bedford, and they have a sweet little theater. It seats about 55 people, and they're always looking for programming. And we had all these films, you know, sort of an archive of films at that point. So we began then. It's a monthly film series, takes place the third Friday of each month, always free of charge. And it's fairly open. We call it documentaries. It's a little play on words. And the idea is to show films not just about commercial fishing, but other aspects of the working waterfront as well. And occasionally we'll have speakers who come either associated with the film or just, for example, in March, we have a couple of authors who are involved in writing a book about coastal schooners, and they're going to come and give a talk about you know, about that history of
so instead
the
last, of a film, it'll
instead
be,
of a film,
yeah.
it'll be a talk and slideshow. But it's, you know, something different every month. And if people are interested in what's coming up, we can
we'll
pass out the website.
Yeah, we'll put a link
absolutely.
On our website. And so now, generally, you have a panel discussion to follow these films.
We do, you know, and that kind of was very organic. It was just at the end of the film, you got the sense that people didn't quite want to get up when there was an issue or a film that was really powerful. And so I just started to say, if people would like to have a conversation, you know, we're happy to. And then more and more when we
we can get somebody who's got some expertise in yeah. you know,
so
the
Sarah
subject.
You'll be there this for the film after
yeah, yeah I'll be there, and I love talking about Bristol Bay, and I love doing these screenings. I've done maybe half a dozen of them, and everyone is so moved every time mm-hmm. they see this movie. And I've done these screenings with fishermen, and when fishermen see it, they tell me everybody needs to see this film. Everybody would get it if they saw this film. And, you know, to me, living in New England and spending my summers in Bristol Bay, that's a big part of my heart that, you know, people around here, I can't share it with them. So when I show this movie, that's a way of sharing that experience with people around here. And I feel it brings me closer to my community to show this film. And so for me personally, it's a powerful experience every time I do it. And so I really do encourage people to attend this screening this Friday at 7 o'clock at the Whaling Museum.
At the National Park, actually.
At the National Park. Oh, and linger in to talk with me. I love talking about Bristol Bay fisheries.
Sarah Schumann, Rhode Island resident, works as a salmon cannery machinist in Bristol. Brett Verhuizen, Federal Fisheries Coordinator for Commercial Fishermen for Bristol Bay, also a lifelong Alaskan fisherman, and Laura Orleans, folklorist and founding director of the Working Waterfront Festival and the festival's documentary series. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Mindy.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you very much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vims produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.